attention. I can't get no call to action, but I try and I try.
Hello and welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, business and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chinwag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It's brought to you by Gasp and I'm Giles Edwards. Today I've caught Steve Harrison and Dave Dye. I doubt there's an industry award of note that's not been lifted by their talented mitts. Steve had his own agency, HTW, which before he left in 2007, bags more Cannes Lion in its discipline than any other in the world. He's also penned both the most expensive ad book of all time and arguably the most provocative. He's been on the show twice before, once guesting, once hosting, and is a great friend of the agency. Dave is the true art director's art director. Through his career, he's won everything, including yesterday's North London Derby, worked for the best agencies in the business, and the visual techniques he uses to squeeze every ounce of juice from an idea are frankly unparalleled. His blog, the suitably and brilliantly titled Stuff from the Loft, is also well worth your time. The pair have joined forces to pen and produce The Howard Gossage Show, a fitting celebration of the fun and fame-peddling showman, one of the industry's lesser-known greats. At a time when advertising is disliked and avoided by most people, his legacy feels even more important now than it was 60 years ago. Their book says, in recent years, creative agencies seem to have lost confidence and direction, and as a result, their audience, where once the public could recite the ads they saw and hum the ones they heard, the work is now unnoticed, which is why we all need Gossage. Welcome back to the show, Steve, and welcome, Dave.
Thanks, Charles.
Thanks, Giles. Thank you.
Right, quick fire questions. I'm going to start with you, Dave. Fountain pen or paperweight?
Fountain pen. I'm literally holding one now.
Steve, More Bullmore or Anatomy of Humbug?
Oh, God. I'm afraid I've got to go with Jeremy. More Bullmore.
Dave, key cutter or film director?
Yeah, I don't remember where that came from. Key cutter or film director? I mean, key cutters are underrated, I think. I think they deserve more of a light shot on them.
Nice. Steve, Posh Spice or Persil?
Persil.
Right, Dave, we've got a colour one here now. So, Dorian Gray or Mediocre?
Go Mediocre, I think.
Nice. I love that work. Steve, coupons or internet?
Coupons.
These are too easy. All right, lastly, Dave, this is a bit of an Ogilvy or Gossage one. The loudest noise is the electric clock, or is it the roar of the engine?
At the moment, I'll have the roar of the engine.
Nice. And lastly, Steve, write to everyone or someone.
Well, Gossage did both, ultimately. He said he couldn't write to everybody, but he achieved. I'm probably getting too close into it, but I'll say write to somebody.
Nice. Yeah, that previous one I gave to Dave, I'd never seen that parody of the ad. I'd never seen that Land Rover ad.
You know? Right.
It's funny, but I mean, it's it feels very contemporary, that. It's just a sort of fuck-off response.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's amazing. I'd never seen it. So, yeah, I mean, for that alone, this book is worth reading, but we'll plug it a bit more as we go on.
And there's a plug for yours. I think you, in How Do Brands Blow, you actually revealed that David Ogilvy copied that the original Rolls-Royce word for word from an ad that he'd seen years ago, isn't it?
Yes.
So it was a double parody or homage or whatever.
Lovely. Nice. Okay. Well, as you know, we always typically ask every guest about their path to where they are now. So any listener who wants to hear about Steve's first ever jobs and first what he regards proper job, we'll link to his episode in the show notes. Dave will be returning soon and appropriately for his own episode. So do stay tuned to that. But we're talking about Howard Gossage today. So Steve, what can you tell us about what kind of shaped Howard Gossage and how he got into the industry?
Okay, Howard Gossage, King, he was graduated in 1939, then went to work for his father Clyde's record shop in Houston. a bit of a loose end. I don't think he was drafted. I think he enlisted in the U.S. Navy. Well, was there for the entire duration of the World War II. Emerged as a hero, winning not one but two Purple Hearts, and the commander of an entire bomber squadron. I think he discharged himself honorably, of course. And then, having been a hero and an officer and having the status of that, was in an entity back on Civvy Street. And interestingly, in an exchange, with his first wife, Frances, in 1960s, he said, "There is one thing I cannot forgive you for. You let me get out of the Navy. I like to drink. In fact, I'm a lush, and I like to think of a Navy career as the best way for me." And I think that he was then let loose, like hundreds of thousands of World War II vets were dumped, basically, in California with no real, no roots back. You know, they'd now be described as suffering, I'm sure, from post-traumatic stress syndrome. And Howard was one of those hundreds of thousands of people who were dumped in, you know, San Francisco, demobbed, and never got back to real life, you know, ordinary life. And he drifted for 3 years. I don't know what he did for 3 years, but in 1949, he got a job as a sales promotion guy for a radio station, KLX, and was very good at it. Very good at it. He won awards. He made his way into the paper, promoting both his clients and himself. He then took a copywriting course with Herb Reynolds, a master of the soft sell. He got a job at Charles Stewart & Co., an advertising agency, as a writer, and wrote his first ads. The first, and that is, we have got them in the book, on page 20, the Bank of America ads. He then, rootless, restless, took his PhD through the GI Bill of Rights. I always think Howard had a mind on fast spin and was probably didn't have the application to sit through the three, four, 5 years it takes to work on just one thesis for a PhD. So he dropped out of that, returned married and jobless and I think penniless to San Francisco, and managed to get a job at Brisacher Wheeler and Staff. Now, I erroneously in the book say he got a job as a junior writer, but Dave has subsequently carried on researching. And what title did he find Howard had, Dave?
I think he was head of television, which is bizarre because we couldn't find any television at EW.
Well, we found the Milky Way script, which he decided was so bad. He said, I don't want to get interested in this. So yeah, the one medium he couldn't handle was telly, and yet he landed the job at Brisacher as head of TV. And that's when he wrote to the creative director and he said, "Just give me an account that nobody wants. Give me an account that's an absolute dog and let me just work on it, please." And that account was Qantas, the Australian international airline. And the rest is what our book is about, I suppose.
So do you think there was any intent or anything in his early days that pointed him towards the industry? Or do you think, much like I assume, that someone like Howard Gossage could have gone into, you know, all sorts of different industries and excelled?
I think he had a natural bent for publicity, publicizing both his clients and his gurus, as we found out with Marshall McLuhan and Leo Polkow, and of course, ultimately and most expertly, himself. And he led a miserable childhood. And the one highlight of his childhood, he recounts, was when, having read Huckleberry Finn, he and a friend set off down the Mississippi on a 44-day journey down the Mississippi, which was publicized in every stop that they made. He would go to the editor of the local newspaper and recount his adventures, probably most of them fictitious, I imagine, knowing Howard, and managed to get himself in the papers, on the radio. And that was at the age of 17, I think it was. So he just had a gift, a bent, and a hunger, I think, for publicity and fame.
Dave, just to bring you in, can I ask, how much, if at all, of an influence was Gossage to you or has been to you during your career? Because he's obviously, you know, referred to as, you know, one of the lesser known greats.
Not too much, to be honest. I mean, I was more aware of him. I bought the book of Gossage when it came out, which I think was the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
Disappointedly, there weren't many pictures in it. But I was, I always thought his quotes were really good. You know, one of my favourites on advertising is the people don't read ads, they read what interests them, and sometimes that's an ad. Because it just seems such a good start for it. You know, so many people, I think particularly now, it feels like, I don't know whether it's agencies, clients, both, but it feels like the start point is people are really interested in what we've got to say, now they actually say it. And I like starting the other way around, which is nobody gives a shit about us or our dark little ad. How do we get their attention? So framing it like that, I've always really loved that. I mean, there's many others that he said that are good, but that in particular. So I was kind of aware of those. I was aware of, from a distance, you know, I would obviously be aware of the pink hair and the kangaroo stuff for Qantas and various bits and pieces I'd seen. But his work, it was not shuffled around as much as Bambach's or others, and partly because there wasn't much of it around. So as I used to do, you know, when I was doing my blog, I'd now again go on a search through a million books and magazines for something on someone else. And if I'd find any that were his, I'd scan them and put them to one side, mainly because there would be such better copies than I'd seen anywhere else. And then I think in retrospect, looking at his work now, the art direction is particularly, I think, is really good. But I think at the time it looked so out of step with the times that it was kind of ignored.
Yeah. So, and in terms of why, I mean, asking someone why they decided to write a book isn't often the best question, but I think the timing around the book is what interests me the most. Did you see putting this book together as a reason to explore and a kind of discovery session of sorts, going through all of the archive ads, as you say, because there wasn't, you know, particularly many that currently existed? Or do you see this as much as doing a service for the industry today, as in the more people we can get to read this book, the better the industry will be as a result?
I remember saying to Dave, probably last June, July, when we were, and it was in its gestative stage, I said, Dave, we have got the gestalt by the bollocks here.
Yeah, that's
right. I said, if ever the industry needed an injection of fun, frivolity, entertainment, and showbiz, it is now. I think the industry is ripe for this message, as the response to the book seems to have indicated.
Yeah, absolutely. I like, Dave, your point then about making something interesting and, you know, no one gives a shit, so why should I be interested in that? It reminds me a bit of that McGraw-Hill ad that we used to have up in our old office, which follows the same kind of line, albeit at a later date, about, you know, I don't know who you are.
Oh, yeah, they got one with the old man. Yes,
that's it. Yeah,
it's funny. Whenever I have to, if I explain the book to anyone, I feel like I'm always apologising that there's lots of wordy non-copy ads that feel like they're from the past. But essentially, they're like the start of PR campaigns, you know. And there used to be an agency, Crispin Porter McGusky, that you know, at the start of the digital age, and they were leading that. They did great work. You know, their question would be, "What would Gossage do? How would he tackle it?" Which is a sort of quirky thing. And so they translated that into let's write the PR brief first, then figure out what the ads are afterwards. So I think, you know, when you look at some of the ads, or if you flick through like a flickbook, you'd think they don't seem very relevant to today. But I think when you read them and absorb them, they couldn't be more relevant, because it's all about engaging people and creating dialogue with people.
Well, there's a great quote of his, and I'm sure we could quote him all day, of ideally an ad should be like one end of an interesting conversation.
Exactly.
And maybe that nod to that rather unfair quickfire we asked Steve of write to everyone or write to someone. It's just something that is, you know, you alluded to there. It doesn't necessarily happen today. It's more about finding the means to shout at someone and target that individual and say what we want to say. There's less regard, perhaps. But saying that, am I being blinkered? One criticism of sorts I find of the kind of rhetoric you can have when we celebrate late greats is that everything looks better in the rearview mirror, like looking back at the past and celebrating this great era, when the reality, I find it quite encouraging reading the book, that actually he wasn't always appreciated, he wasn't always appreciated at the time himself, was he? So in that way, in many ways, he was a maverick that we can appreciate now. But was he appreciated at the time, do you think, Steve?
No, for a couple of reasons. He went out of his way not to be appreciated. Practicing what he preached to his clients and to his gurus like Marshall McLuhan and Leopold Kohl, he said things. Marshall McLuhan used to drop probes, he used to describe them as. He didn't necessarily mean them or really think them through, but he dropped them in order to stimulate thought and response and the reaction. And Howard was a vehement critic of the industry, I think, genuinely, sincerely, but also because he knew that it would antagonize people and it would generate column inches, you know? So I think that was one of the reasons he was unpopular. But the other reason was that his advertising style was that of sales promotion and direct response work. And it in those days, believe me, it looked very dated. And the fashionable route was three-quarter size image, three columns type. You start with a gag at the beginning of the copy, you end with a gag at the end of the copy, which was the antithesis of where Gossage was. He had his gags going throughout the bloody copy. I think they looked down their nose at him in the way that, if you don't mind me saying so, above-the-line advertising has always looked down its nose at response and sales promotion work. And Howard was basically a sales promotion guy rather than a classic, what you might call, above-the-line advertising man. So, no, he wasn't appreciated. It was only the Germans, strangely enough, who turned him into a cult figure, and that was in the late 1960s.
I think it's interesting that, you know, we've got some of the quotes in the book from Dan Wyden, Jeff Goodby, and Alex Bogusky, who have three of the most awarded agencies in the last 20 years. But if you go through the awards books, you struggle to find any Howard Gossage. And normally the people that those big award-winning creative guys like are people who've won tons of awards. And he didn't really win many awards. Not that I could ever find.
Well, we all know, don't we, that awards juries are slightly coloured by what is fashionable that moment, the fashions of the day, don't we? And it's very difficult to break through what the conventional wisdom of what an award-winning ad looks like.
I'm not going. I'm going to choose not to interpret that as revisiting the debate you had with Tim Lindsay a few years ago. But on him especially, Steve, I was rather pleasantly surprised to see you agreeing with him in your recent posts about the book.
Well, I honestly, we say on the back page that, what is it? It says recently creative industries have lost their confidence and direction, most dangerous to their audience. And I think you can't get greater substantiation for that assertion than Tim when he says, quote, "Where once the public rather liked advertising and we liked working in the business, our consuming public now do pretty much anything to avoid it. And sadly, a lot of us are looking for ways to leave." I couldn't agree more, Tim. I do kind of believe that as CEO of the DNAD, you might have done something to sell advertising's commercial values as opposed to its social purpose. But then again, we'll park that one. But I'd then go to the developed that by quoting a much respected advertising luminary, and that's Paul Feldwick, who's in Why Does the Peddler Sing? Goes to the root of the problem when he says advertising's roots lie with the peddlers, hawkers, and barkers who pull their punters and push their wares by being entertaining. It was their shtick that made them stand out from the crowd and their message memorable. And Paul argues that we've basically, for the past 10 years, 15 years, held our collective noses and dignified our roles with lots of pretentious bullshit and let ideological intellectual conceits distance us from the audience who now, as Tim says, wouldn't touch us with a barge pole. And I think this is where Gossage comes to the fore, that he was from that school of peddlers, hawkers and barkers, and he knew that his audience's attention, involvement and response was paramount, and he would do virtually anything to achieve that. Not anything, but he set his stall out to achieve getting their attention, their involvement and their affection, which is something advertising singularly fails to do nowadays.
Yeah. During his time, he talked about, in fact, there's a line in your book, doing better advertising wasn't enough because most of it, in his words, was bad enough to rot the paper in which it appeared. So what were the conventions that Howard Gossage kind of rallied against during his time?
God, Dave, I mean, it was this that I think appealed to you, wasn't it, Dave?
Well, I guess it's a bit like the stuff we were saying earlier, which is, on the face of it, the ads look very, they could look more conventional. They're very neat. They use old-fashioned serif-looking fonts and little subheads and bits and pieces everywhere. But when you read them, they're very subversive and playful and kind of naughty, which is what I like. It looks like he's just messing about, you know, thinking, what can we fuck around with on this coupon? And it feels like he's just enjoying himself. So I think actually they're quite subversive, although they present themselves as quite classic, sensible looking. You know, the point about the time is typical, because I remember when I first got into the business, obviously years and years ago now, there was always this cliche that every time, and this is now looked back at as a golden age, you know, like the 80s and 90s, that the cliche was that after every P&AD jury that the statement would go out is, it's not a classic year. Whereas now people look back and think, oh, what a classic year. So it's difficult when you're in the middle of it. And that's sometimes now and again, you know, when we sort of look around us now, you think, was it just us that it all seems a bit flat a lot generally, or not, or is it? So I think it's obviously easier judging anything from a distance.
As far as the conventions are concerned, though, I mean, you look at the work he did for Rover, and there's, so to begin with, he did one ad in which he said, we're not going to tell you what the product is, who the brand is, you know, but if you're interested, write in and we'll let you know, you know. So
write in and we'll tell you what this ad's for, essentially, which is...
You know, and then the convention in all car ads is to show a beauty shot of the product, and then Gossage shot one with it cropped so you just see the roof and perhaps the windows, you know, kind of not enough room to show the product. It is a, you know, kind of the you know, when in doubt, use a testimonial or a case study. And the testimonials very often revolve around scientific breakthroughs or sporting events or sporting achievements or celebrities. Gossage wrote his case study testimonial around the Great Train Robbery and how the Land Rover was used in what was the UK's crime of the century, you know, kind of, and the beauty of, and he said, well, it gives you an impression of just how much you can get into the back of the car when you think that you loaded £30 million worth of banknotes into the back of it. You know, I don't know. I mean, the Great Train Robbers didn't get away with it, but Gossage did, and I don't know how, you know, even tiny things. Dave says they look like standard ads, but when you read them, how about this for a call to action? Certain people, we mention no names, but we know who you are, have not sent in your entries. This is absolutely your last warning, uppercase. Do you understand? Mail this coupon today. I mean, that is a call to action, but a spoof. No, he knew people. He knew the formula. He knew people knew the formula, and he knew they were in on the gag, you know. And they loved it. They loved rolling with it.
Yeah, that call to action you just read out, Steve. I've got about a dozen runouts here, all from photos I've crudely taken on my phone over the weekend while I was reading it, trying to limit them to the ones that I loved the most. But I've got this like ridiculous archive of poorly taken photos. It's like the opposite of what Dave probably has. So I really sharp, love
yes,
the scan.
Yes.
But it's amazing. And even that nod to the, you know, the train robbery, it's that kind of piggybacking on fame that exceeds the industry that I think is so...
Yes, I know, but a larcenist.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like... mean, piggybacking on fame is a, you know, a standard technique, but to persuade the client to use the crime of the century, in which, let's remember, the poor train driver was reduced to a vegetable as a result of being bashed on the head with an iron bar. And, you know, kind of the audacity of it.
I think the audacity as well might even kind of bleed over to just the level of engagement that whether he demanded or whether he expected from his ad. So whether it was, you know, some of the ads you've just shared, or whether it was running that double page spread with a blank page, or splitting the copy across an ad that might appear in a later edition of the New Yorker. I mean, it's just fascinating. Yeah. It's amazing how kind of like on edge people must have been in order to for that to be effective. It's wonderful.
As we know, you know, kind of the classic example is ending an ad halfway through a sentence and then next week starting the next ad halfway through the sentence and continuing the story, doing that for four consecutive ads. You know, and if you want to talk about breaking convention, then that is or running a headline, I mean, and then breaking the conventions of the hard sell. I mean, the classic, if you're driving down the road and you see a Fina station and it's on your side so you don't have to make a U-turn through traffic and there aren't six cars waiting and you need gas or something, please pop in. That, again, I think is rather unconventional, isn't it?
Yeah.
They're absolutely. Also absolutely living by this thing of people read what interests them. You know, that you. So to start with the great train robbers, when that's a big story, you know, it's hard to ignore that. If you're not interested in the car, you think, oh, did they use one of those or what? You know, you're dragged in and it happens to be an ad. Or there's a whole bunch of Paul Masson ads where one of them, he talks about why we clink glasses together, say, so cheers, or other stuff that you know, that tangentially linked to the product, but you're drawn in because you want to know the answer. I mean, or the ultimate one is the Rover one. We just, you know, write in and we'll tell you what we're advertising or what we're ads for. It's really hard to not think, well, what the fuck is it first? Just read the first paragraph, see if I can work it out. Before you know it, you've read through the thing. So he's dragging you in every time.
You opened a can of worms here, Giles, with, well, what conventions did he break? He was asked to write radio spots for Weinhardt Blitz beer. And what he and Stan Freberg came up with was not a radio spots, but a 25-minute stage musical called Oregon, Oregon, which was arranged and conducted by Billy May, who usually worked with Frank Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald, and Nat King Cole. A 25-minute, that was the radio spot, which then became a real stage show, which then became a long-playing record. You know, kind of, so you ask him for half a dozen radio commercials and God knows what he's going to come back with.
Yeah. We talked the other day about the industry needing to take itself less seriously. And we speculated that the loss of confidence that I think certainly exists, and I'm sure one of you made that point ahead of me, has contributed to that. Do you think Howard Gossage ever had a loss of confidence during his career? Because he certainly got knocked.
Yeah, I mean, he was at the end of the first part of the book. I think you get some insight into just how hard he worked in order to achieve what appear to be irreverent, funny, amusing campaigns. You talk about, you know, kind of the famous the truism about comedians being tragic souls. As he said earlier on, that having an idea is like giving birth to a baby grand piano, you know. So he was racked by doubt, self-doubt, and was a horrible person to work with, according to Alice Lowe, you know, when he was trying to have the ideas. And he was terrified that he wouldn't be able to match, to top or maintain the standard that he'd achieved in the past. Yeah, you know, the image of the devil may care, debonair cavalier is slightly misleading. I think it was there have been suggestions of him being manic depressive. Having known a few manic depressives in my life, Howard never took 3 months out. You know, which is what true manic depression involves, I think. He had mood shifts, definitely mood shifts. And Alice Lowe was basically tasked with getting him back in the office when he retreated to his home and wouldn't come out, you know. So, yeah, he lived with the constant potential or imminence of failure, you know.
Yeah. And the way this book is, well, the art direction of the book and the way it's put together follows that chronological path. Dave, did you find in discovering and then putting these ads in this order, it did give you a nice chronological view of Howard's life, not just his work?
I think if you line the ads up, sometimes, you know, if I do a profile on someone, you can line the work up and see it evolve and change through the years and through the, you know, the different fashions and trends. Whereas I don't know whether Howard's does. It felt like you could probably shuffle it around and it wasn't very trendy at the time.
Right.
So it really doesn't feel very old fashioned in retrospect. You know, it feels like he's got his way of doing things and that's it really. You know, certain things may change a little, but not that much, I don't think. You know, there's certain tools that he uses, like little printer's pointy fingers and little brackets around subheads, and that seem continuous, you know. So a lot of those, they run throughout. Do you think his work changed through the years?
No, I don't. I think that he nailed it by 1950. Once the Qantas thing, the Qantas campaign, where they'd be the first on your block to win a kangaroo, he seems to have determined never to do a conventional ad. He'd got into the rhythm of a style of advertising, which he would then spoof and send up, which always had a product benefit to it. I mean, let's not get away with this. There was always a commercial intent back there. If you look at the Fina work, I do explain it in pretty, you know, I don't like to go into much detail in the book in order to leave the stage open to Howard, but I do on page 39 explain that he ticked every box on the client's brief, and more so, and every ad is selling. But he'd got this wonderful, he'd hit this wonderful rhythm. And the thing was, I think that his readers, if you're reading the book now, once you get into the rhythm, you find it's just so engaging. And I think he'd hit that stride. And I think that's why he couldn't allow, and, you know, he knew it worked, and he couldn't allow any other of the writers to take over. He had to write all the ads because he wanted to keep this house style going. And until he exhausted himself by 1965-66.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, you pay homage to, I mean, Paul Feldwick already has come up a couple of times, and you nod to Bob Hoffman and his famous three-word brief he shared recently, which should be "Make me famous." But I'm pleased you mentioned about there was always a commercial intent, because it's not just making people famous for the sake of it. But he was always just dead set on using whatever means he could to make his clients famous beyond the realms of Adland. And perhaps today we're too caught up in defining and slicing a very tight segment of people that we only want to communicate to.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it goes back to the thing we were talking about earlier. I don't know what the latest figures on, but a few years ago, I think people were taking in over 2,000 ads a day, because obviously they're coming at you all angles now. And obviously 1,995 of those are ignored and they're not remembered at the end of the day. So certain things, when you're funny or seemingly frivolous or whimsical or whatever it may be, they can look indulgent to some clients. You think, well, can't we just get to the point? And you can get to the point, and people screen it out and ignore it. So you have to be clever about how you hook people in and how you start engaging them. I mean, I imagine trying to sell that ad now that said, "Write in and we'll tell you what it is." It would be horrific to imagine trying to get someone to do something like that. So until you really are honest about what's cutting through, what you know, I used to do lots of presentations selling a campaign, and I'd say, according to data, it's 2 o'clock, you've seen about 1,200 ads, or maybe. Now, can you name one? Let's go around the room and see if you can name one. And obviously, 100 times out of 100 they go, I think I saw one last week. And you go, well, so let's not do something that performs in the same way.
Yeah.
But I think the industry has, I think the industry has gone out of its way to be, what's the opposite of engaging? You know, kind of in that you've talked about hyper-targeting, but the industry has become hyper-serious over the past 10, 12 years. Kantar research notes that the number of ads using humor went into decline from 2012 onwards and fell off the cliff, basically. And the only rise in humorous ads, as opposed to hyper-serious ads, came in 2022. And Kantar's ad direction study has shown that humor is the most potent way to engage people in a brand message. You know, ads that use humor are more expressive, to a 27-point increase, involving, a 14-point increase, and distinctive, an 11-point increase to ads that are of a serious tone. But the industry has become hyper-serious over the past 10, 12 years.
Why do you think that is, Steve? Why do you think it dropped off in 2000?
Social purpose. Sorry, mate. Social purpose. We all started taking ourselves very, very seriously. If you indulge me, in 2021, Campaign magazine asked the luminaries in the industry. This was at the high peak purpose, right? What does 2021 look like? And Lucy Jameson at Uncommon Studio said, we need to think more like Megan Rapinoe, Marcus Rashford and Kamala Harris. Ferocious caring needs to come to the fore. As strategists, our job is to help pave the way for a different reaction. We have a chance to influence more than a brand's voice. We can influence actions too. So let's find those clients who want to make a difference and advise them how to help. Cheryl Largerum, the CEO of McCann Erickson, said, advertising and activism, there is a moral and commercial imperative here. There's a moral and commercial imperative here. There's been power imbalance for centuries. This is people talking about what will advertising look like over the next 12 months. 12 months ago, Megha Parikh, head of Wunderman Strategy, Wunderman Thompson Atlanta, said, ultimately, I remind myself that the core of our job, our main responsibility, is to inspire bravery. And on the same article, for Tim Walsh, the UK head of strategy at Momentum Worldwide, on the subject of taking sides in culture wars, said, let's not forget, tension is one of the most potent strategic fuels at our disposal. Without tension, our role is somewhat redundant. Insights lack impact. So we've got to build tension. You know, I've just been finishing a fucking shift. Aldi, as a security person, having to put up with physical and verbal abuse from the army of shoplifters who are, you know, kind of going, I go home and I turn telly on. And the last fucking thing I want to see is a TV commercial that makes me even more tense. The industry has lost sight. You know, the people who work in it should be working at NGOs, charities, or they should be running for parliament, you know, but this is... Yeah, like I say, the industry has lost its way and become hyper-serious.
Not all of them. The ones listening to this are obviously nice and intelligent.
Oh, they're all nodding. They're all nodding, going, you're not kidding, mate. Thank God somebody said that. Thank God somebody said it.
I do think, just to throw in something else in the mix, and Dave, I'd love to know what you think about this.
Yeah.
I had the pleasure of hanging out with Bob Hoffman a couple of years ago, or just over a year ago in Sydney, and I saw a talk he gave, and I actually asked his permission to directly quote him on a talk I gave in Oxford recently, and Bob was obviously more than happy for me to amplify his words. I'm going to read it now, but he's talking about that period of time from roughly 2012, and he says, we've gone through what was expected to be one of the most fruitful and productive in the history of marketing and advertising. We have amazing new tools, amazing new technology, and amazing new media that we never had before. The whole thing was intoxicating and certain to lead to all kinds of new opportunities. Our ability to personalize advertising and reach consumers one-to-one would make advertising more relevant, more timely, and more likable. Our ability to listen to consumer conversations through social media and react quickly couldn't help but connect brands more closely with their customers. The opportunity for people to interact with media was certain to make advertising more engaging, and yet by the almost unanimous opinion of people inside and outside the business, the standard has gotten worse. Rather than creating advertising that is more relevant, more timely, and more likable, we're creating advertising that's more annoying, more disliked, and more avoided. So sorry, it's a bit of a long one, and yeah. I don't disagree with Steve's point, but I do think this has a lot to answer for.
Well, I think that pre-digital, the big skill was working in the time lengths that you had, or the sizes that you had, and trying to get someone's attention. I mean, the two very basic things, getting someone's attention, and then how do you do it in this size or this time length? Once digital started to get going, you could make films of any length and put them online, you know, so it all of a sudden you didn't have to limit yourself to 30 seconds. And because they could find the people and the thing could turn up in their inbox or in their feed and it's going directly to them. It's like, we don't have to bother that much about trying to attract their attention. We know it's going to get directly to them. So it felt like those two things, people took their foot off the gas a bit and thought, we can, you know, maybe it's better if we do a 2-minute version of this, which obviously people aren't any, they don't want to watch a 1-second version of it. So extending it out is unbelievably indulgent. And then the other thing is, it feels like, as I say, a lot of stuff feels like, I mean, it's always been bad. It's not that it was always, it used to be amazing and now it's terrible. It's always been bad. But it feels like the volume of bad has gone up a bit. And that thing of how do we engage people? I mean, that used to be the start point of every brief. How do we get people interested in drawing pins or rubber bands or whatever the brief was? You think people aren't interested in thermal insoles for shoes. How the hell are we going to do something on that that someone's going to engage with? No normal person is interested in that. So that would be a big part of the brief is, you know, what we were talking about, Gossage. He's gone, well, let's talk about the great train robbery. People are interested in that. Let's join those things together, and then you've got someone. So it just feels like, as I say, there's a lot of stuff feels like there's an assumption people will read it from start to finish, and they've got time, and they're interested in your company. So we don't have to deviate from just saying it straight.
Yeah.
I think Gossage's response to this would be also in terms of hyper-targeting. We are not taking out a hunting license on someone else's private preserve, but we are renting a stage on which we may perform. And I think that the reliance upon hyper-targeting, the idea that I could be, you know, sitting on the toilet reaching for the Kleenex and get a message on my phone telling me that I should be buying who gives a crap toilet paper instead, you know, kind of that you could rely upon positioning the message so accurately that you didn't need an idea to make it interesting.
We interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the... Sorry.
Yeah, funnily enough, Nick Myers from Oliver, who I know you know, wrote a short recap from your launch event that sadly I was unable to make it to. And he points the finger at the world of CRM and performance and suggests it needs that massive injection of fun. Because you're right, we don't really think about the fact there's a stage there we're renting. That showmanship is kind of perhaps needing to make a comeback. Do you think it is making a comeback?
I think there's an appreciation that it's absolutely necessary to entertain and engage. I think common sense, hopefully, is prevailing. That, you know, as I say, for the past 12 years, a lot of advertising has been about as much fun as you imagine Greta Thunberg's hen night will be. While it's amused us, while we've been trying to change culture, which is another way of saying using the client's money in order to impose our progressive views upon people, I think the clients are going, hang on a minute. Post cost of living crisis, I think they're saying, I'm sorry, but can we have our budgets back? There's an article in the paper today, in my paper, saying that budgets have been slashed and employment and hirings are down in the advertising industry more than in any sector under analysis. And that was in my paper, that's the headline in my paper. And the headline that came to me from Campaign is that they were going to reveal to us which agency had the biggest gender imbalance as far as their salaries are concerned. And it seems to be we're inwardly looking about ticking our own boxes, as opposed to understanding that we're in the business, we're in a commercial business, and one that is losing its clients and losing its importance. We won't do, you know, kind of advertising that is populist, because, you know, we're all terribly important people and can't be seen to be doing anything as childish.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah. I'm going to move to listener questions. So asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or boat names, is notoriously fraught with danger, but that's not stopped us asking. I shouldn't call them listeners, I should call them friends and certainly ex-guests. We've had a couple in from Nick Asbury. And I think, obviously, I'd love both of your responses, but I'll start with you, Steve. There's two questions. The first one is a little bit tongue-in-cheek, so I'm going to ask them both. And obviously, if you want to answer them both, that's fine. But he starts with, Gossage said, to explain morality to an ad man is like trying to explain to a child that sex is more interesting than ice cream. What's your favourite Ben and Jerry's flavour? The second one, I mean, you're a Blackpool boy, so you should have a favourite ice cream. The second one says, some have cited Gossage, an early proponent of purpose marketing, but in reality, his purposeful ads were for non-profits like the Sierra Club, where purpose belongs. He wasn't in the business of doing social mission ads for commercial clients. What do you think he would have made of purpose?
I agree entirely, and I thank Nick for making that point that... And also, it was Dave who pointed out in the 350 ads that he's found, he hasn't found one charity ad that Howard Gossage wrote. He wrote oars-related ads questioning the whether billboards were a good idea, and also questioning whether newspapers being reliant upon advertising revenue was a good idea. No charity advertising, but some brilliant cause-related advertising towards the end of his writing career. What would he have made of social purpose? I think Howard was a fabulously highly attuned bullshit monitor, and I think that he would have early days. Written the book that, or endorsed the book that Nick has just written, The Road to Hell.
Yep. And favourite ice cream?
Cherry Garcia for me.
Nice.
I wouldn't really get the Aldi route. I'd stick with Cherry Garcia. Or what's the one with the fishes? I like the one with
fish food.
Fish food, I follow that.
An aristocrat, eh?
Oshko.
Nice. I'm going to ask the next question, which comes from the brilliant Vicky Ross, to you, Dave.
Okay.
Vicky says, my favourite thing about Gossage is how he left readers hanging with his Whiskey Distillers of Ireland ads. I once had a client ask why there was a one-word sentence in the middle of a paragraph, so I can't imagine getting half a story signed off. What would you say to a client who sits on the safe side of creativity? I imagine that's a conversation you've had a fair few times.
I find it... I was going to say this earlier. I find the whole thing about being brave and safe, and it's such a confusing quagmire to me, because obviously the brave thing is to do stuff that people are going to engage with. Or doing boring stuff or very, very straight stuff to me is really brave, because people aren't interested in it. They'll ignore it. Doing stuff that's interesting or funny or whatever isn't brave. So I find all the, you know, I've just done this work with Creed recently, and it's all about the line is cut different, and it's a sort of global thing, and all the bottles are cut, sliced. They're like bits of art, and it's this Creed cut. And they've gone all over the place. Anyway, that was at a launch party the other end. There was about three clients from America going and said, oh, you're so brave to do that work. We think it's really brave. You think, what? And I said, it's not me being brave. You approved it. It's like, is it I can draw anything and say, what about this? But actually approving it is the brave thing.
I remember I gave a talk with Ryan Woolman, who obviously is the bigger brain behind our books, and we made the same point. It was about being right, not about being brave.
Exactly. I mean, I've also got a slight issue with... I mean, there's a lot of the terms I wish we could change. Like, I don't really like the term creatives, which I know is a bit of a weird one, but because I think it puts you in a little playful head. It's like, oh, this lot colour in and they play around. It's as if you're not really very sensible or understand business or going to help anyone's business. It's like, and I think, you know, that's why often creatives start, they want to look a certain way. It used to be when I started, people, you would never find a creative who would wear a suit, you know, because that would be ridiculous. So wear jeans and certain things. And I think it encourages a certain behavior, which then is tricky when you're then dealing with clients. It's as if you don't really, your goal is to be creative, not to help the business improve or sell more stuff.
And I suppose that you visually don't look like you belong in the boardroom as well, which is a big issue.
No, exactly. Yeah, you're saying, I'm not one of you lot. And I think a lot of people like that because they go, oh, I'm very different. I'm not like those boring guys in suits. And you think, I don't know whether that's helpful, really, to say, you know, we don't really get your world.
That's a really good point. Do you have a similar thought to Can introducing humour as a different category as opposed to something that should be read?
Yeah, I mean, that's just ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, that says funny commercials are very niche. You know, it's like, what, you know, we Steve and I were talking about this the other day. I bet most people, if they were asked to list their top 10 ads, 8 would be funny, if not more.
Yeah.
You know, who likes really sad ads or really, you know, it's generally the ones that you talk about with your friends or you respond to are funny. Have you seen this? Look at this. Watch this. And I think, why you would hive off humor is just bizarre to me. And also, the other thing is, how do you judge it? Well, if I think it's funnier than you think it's funny, who's right? What a nightmare to judge, with it, particularly with people from different, you know, you've got a German, a Hungarian, a Brit, you know.
That sounds like the start of a joke in itself, Dave.
Yeah, I was going down that route. But you think, who decides whether it's funny? Is it funny to, in your language? Or, I mean, yeah, so it sounds like a nightmare. I mean, obviously, awards are forever trying to slice up the pie to get as much revenue out of these things as possible. But it seems a shame. I mean, I would hive off anything that isn't selling, you know, like they used to do when I was on the DNAD committee. We decided that public service and charity, because that stuff was winning all the awards, and it felt a bit unfair that if you've got a car brief on the one hand and then you've got a brief for some sort of, you know, blindness, helping the blind on the other, they don't feel equal, you know, in scale or beer. You know, you've got nothing you can say about a beer. You can talk emotionally forever about helping children not to be blind. And so they were hived off into, well, let's keep those in one section. Whereas now, most awards, that's the kind of stuff that dominates.
Yeah. So, just bringing it back to Vicky's question, if you have a client who understands what we would regard as being, you know, I suppose, right, as being brave, how do you sell in that commercial significance of, you know, breaking conventions?
Well, I would try and have a conversation with them about what they respond to and what their family responds to and what stuff they've noticed and what they haven't noticed, that not really think of it in terms of, is it conventional or not conventional, and try and get to the bottom of what things they respond to as a human being, not what they do as a marketing director. And I think when you're into convention versus non-convention, this thing that, you know, essentially you're trying to, I mean, if it's a TV commercial, you know, you're trying to think, well, would that stop you in the first 5 seconds, 10 seconds? Do you get it? Would you tell anyone about it? I mean, all basic stuff, really. And I think that's sort of honest for me anyway. I mean, people do this thing. For me, that's always been a much more useful thing, to try and have an honest conversation. You've got to be honest back. You can't just sell your thing. But to try and say, well, is that stop, you know, would that stop you making a tea? Would you tell your friend about it? Would you remember it the next day? And if you're really honest with those sort of things, you have to reject a hell of a lot of work.
Yes. Yeah.
So I would reduce it to a more human, smaller scale thing. I think if you're going in saying we need to break conventions, be brave and buck the system and all that sort of stuff, most clients, it's like, well, it's not really my job, you know. So I would reduce it down to a more basic, tangible thing and try to understand how they respond to things.
Yeah, I think there's so many woolly, ambiguous metrics that we kind of judge success by anyway. And I think Make Us Famous is obviously one that we, you know, we all agree is significant. But I do like the kind of niche measure of stopping someone making a cup of tea. I just wish there was an easier way of accessing
that. Yeah, I mean, there was a really good thing that Dave Trott wrote the other day. It's funny, I was telling someone about it and I thought it sounds so stupidly, obviously dumb. So he said something like, there's three things and you have to do them in the right order. First thing is you have to stop someone. Then you have to explain what you have to then judge whether it's clear, and then you have to judge whether it's persuasive.
Yeah.
And obviously that's almost so basically, that sounds so stupid once you say it out loud. You think, well, obviously that's the case. But if you look at most work, it doesn't adhere to those things. And he says you can't do it in another order. It's got to be that order. Which is incredibly obvious, but most work wouldn't pass that test. So I think, you know, I've talked about this before, but there's very few meetings I've ever attended where the question is, would that stop you? Let's think about that. Like, I remember listening to Alex Taylor talk about Silk Cut. She used to go up to Charles Saatchi, who was a bit like Howard Hughes. Nobody would ever see him or engage with him. She'd get time with him to show in Silk Cut posters. And he had a ludicrously big office, like almost the whole of the top floor of one of their buildings. And he would ask her to show him the posters from where she came in, and he'd be at the other end. So they'd be tiny, and she'd lift them up, and he'd be maybe 50 foot away. You can't follow that one. I don't like that one. And it's like a really easy thing for anyone to do, but few people judge impact, that sort of stuff. They judge how we describe it, this thing, or if we fit it in that thing. It's all the sort of minutiae, but few people judge the core thing is, would you notice it?
Yeah. Yeah, we used to run, I think Dave has it as impact, communication, persuasion, and we used to have that as three tick boxes when we used to present creative, just to help clients understand how we wanted them to review it. And you're absolutely right. And maybe that's when we were talking about CRM and technology, that's kind of probably very guilty of doing parts two and three, perhaps, but not even, addressing part one, which obviously Howard Gossage was very good at doing.
So when you look at that, you think, well, my mum could have written that. I mean, she couldn't, but it seems so blindingly obvious. You can't believe everybody wouldn't make that as a judgment. Anyway,
the other thing that a slide that I use when I, in the infrequent times I am asked to do a talk, is a quote from my mum, who turns 80 this year. And it's just her quote over a picture of Gio Campario, the Go Compare opera singer fella.
Oh, yeah.
And it's something along the lines of, I hate that bloke, but whenever I need insurance, I think of him.
Yeah, exactly.
Just to kind of remind people. Steve, you got anything else to add to that?
No.
No. Fantastic. Okay, so listen, are there any plans? I know that there's a hell of an archive that you've put together here in the book. Am I allowed to suggest that I know that you've subsequently found even more work from Howard Gossage?
Oh, of course you can. Yeah, I think it's one of those things I've occasionally, in a bit of downtime, think, I want to go up and find this, or I want to go up and find that. So there are, there's things that popped up, yeah.
Yeah. And is there any plans to do anything else with that, or move on to anyone else in particular?
I think we're still in the, I think, the gestative stages of this book launch, to be quite honest.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for joining me. Thank you for talking about Howard Gossage. We've barely scratched the surface, I would suggest, of the, close to 200 pages. What's the best way of getting hold of the book?
Well, I would suggest, if you're an advertising agency, that you get Dave and I in to give you the Howard Gossage show. And we will happily bring you a box full of books that you can then distribute to your staff. So we're already doing this for three or four agencies. It is the Howard Gossage Roadshow, and we'd be quite happy to bring it to an agency near you.
Nice. Okay, fantastic. Well, if you can share with me the best way of getting in touch with you that we can include in this pod's listing, we'll do that. And I was going to ask, how else can they get more Howard Gossage? So obviously there's the biography you've penned previously, Steve. Yeah. The film seems to be quite elusive. I have tried and succeeded in tracking it down in the past, but I have tried again recently and had less luck.
The intention was to release it with the book, but we figured that we'd be single-minded about getting the Howard Gossage Show out rather than a film that had the title Changing the World is the Only Fit Work for a Grown Man. Which the film was the companion piece to the book, and we'll probably let the film out once the Howard Gossage Show has played in, you know, kind of in the provinces and is, you know, kind of, yeah, that was, once we've finished with that one.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, everyone listening then, the final call to action is to head over to this episode online. We'll share all of the extra links. There may be some bonus links in there to past literature and material. We'll link to Steve's previous appearances on Call to Action and remind you that Dave will be joining us again in the near future. We do always dedicate every episode to someone, so if you would kindly do the honors, Steve, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, the only person I could do it for is Alice Lowe. Alice was the organizer, was Howard's organizer. She kept his deadlines. She paid his bills. She also organized the fabulous parties that Gossage would throw with her 15-minute party plan when he'd decide that, come on, get the mariachis, get the catering in. Well, that's enough work for one day. And which he'd invite people like John Houston and, you know, Dr. Benjamin Spock and, you know, kind of Tom Wolfe and whatever. But more than that, she looked after him. As I said, that when he was going into one of his moods, it was Alice who got him back into work. She coached him back into work, and she stood up to him. And he used to say, okay, tell it like it is, Al, you know, Big Al, sorry. And she spent 2 years sorting out the tangled financial affairs once the agency was wrapped up, and kept his memory alive by writing her own biography, sadly unpublished, but watch this space. And then keeping this fabulous archive, which, as when she died 3 years ago, she left to Jeff Goodby with this strict instructions to have it housed in the Bancroft Library at University of California, Berkeley, because she kept box upon box of stuff of Howard Gossage memorabilia. And she wanted it to be made available to everybody, you know. She wanted everybody to have access to it, and it has been accepted by the Bancroft Library, and we are just at the moment in the process of organizing the collection, really. Well, Alice Lowe, I would dedicate this one to Big Al.
Yeah, okay, fantastic. Well, this episode is very proudly dedicated to Big Al, Alice Lowe. Dave, anything else from you before we go?
I can't think of a dedication. Ben and Jerry's fish food.
Ben and Jerry's fish food. That's wonderful. Well, listen, both, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure and a privilege to talk. Thank you to everyone listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do go and buy the book. It's even better. There are links, as I've suggested. You can get hold of Steve and Mr. Dye himself. Get them in to do a talk and give out the books, because I think with their help, we might just make the industry better. To get in touch with us, it's easy to find GASP online, or you can just email calltoaction@gasp.agency.
I can't get no call to action. But I try. I can't get no call to action. Oh, I can't get no call to action. Yeah, hey, hey.